That is? We all look down to the bag of pot in Garrett's lap. Garrett says, "Oh, shit," and another promising political career goes down in flames. The others speak up now, but everything they say just makes it worse. "It's not what you think," says Alyssa. "It came with the car," says Kelton. "It's just oregano," says Jackie. Graves rarely gets so deep. "All right, out of the truck," says the soldier using his no-nonsense boot camp voice. "I said out, now!" And so we scramble to do what he says, because red-handed is red-handed, and this is martial law, and Jackie's motivational poster is truer than anything right now. We are screwed, and I cannot see a way out of this. He takes the keys from Jackie, leaving us without wheels. "Turn around," he demands, waving his weapon. "Hands up against the vehicle." I try, but I grimace. "I said hands up!" "I can't," I tell him. "I dislocated my shoulder." "It's true," says Kelton. "I dislocated it." "Just keep your hands where I can see them," he says, mercifully not forcing my arm out of joint again. But now I'm scared. Truly and honestly scared, because I can see that there are others who are sitting handcuffed on the curb. Troublemakers or brawlers, or other sorts of unpleasant characters who required restraint, and God knows where they go under martial law. I try to hold it together, because leadership requires at least a pretense of grace under pressure. And then Alyssa opens her mouth, and what comes out is downright magical. "So you're going to arrest a bunch of kids for having pot? It's legal now, you know?" "Not in a moving vehicle," the soldier says as he begins to frisk us. "And you're all underage." But Alyssa will not be deterred. "Really? Is this your top priority in the middle of this crisis?" "Be quiet," the soldier orders. He pats Kelton down, and is about to move on to Alyssa.
"This is physical and psychological intimidation of minors. Not even martial law allows that," she yells. "I'm sure my cousin at the LA Times is going to love this story."
And miraculously, he backs off. But not before grabbing the bag of weed. "I'm confiscating this," he says. "Now move it. Get in line with everyone else." And just like that, we're free. With so many people to process, I guess arresting us just wasn't worth the hassle. We hurry away from the soldier, passing all the forlorn people handcuffed by the curb, and join the mob heading toward the school, all of us breathing a communal sigh of relief. "That," I tell Alyssa, "was masterful. And it's not even like I'm sucking up. I mean it. You completely saved us back there, and you didn't even have to lie."
"Actually," says Alyssa, "I don't have a cousin who works for the LA Times."
And suddenly, I think I might be in love.
Alyssa.
"Maybe, I think. Maybe this will be okay. Now that the tap out is being taken seriously, now that all these resources are being mobilized, it will be okay. We won't have to brave the journey to this mysterious bug out, which always sounded sketchy to me anyway. But Kelton is like an animal in a trap, and he's ready to chew off his own foot to escape. He halts, refusing to walk any farther, standing in the middle of the path. The four of us have to fight the current of people to not get swept away with it. 'We can't be here,' he insists. 'But we are,' Jackie tells him, butting back. 'Deal with it.' Considering all that Kelton has been through, I think he needs better than a tough love approach from someone who doesn't actually love him, so I try to be a little bit gentler. 'Maybe this is a good thing,' I tell him. 'It's not like we're prisoners. They aren't making us stay if we don't want to. And who knows, maybe we do want to. But now that we're standing here like boulders against the relentless flow of people entering the evac center, it doesn't feel like much of a choice at all.' 'Maybe Mom and Dad are here,' Garrett shouts over the clamor of helicopter blades. 'Though I think if they were here, they would have left to come to get us. Or maybe, like the soldier was going to do for our imaginary grandma, They sent someone to get us, but we were already gone. It's possible, I tell Garrett, because I don't want to shatter his hopes. And then Jackie yells, "Where the hell is Roycroft?" I look behind us, and he's not there. He's vanished completely. "Forget about him," growls Kelton. Someone knocks into him, and he almost loses his footing. "If he wants to stay here, let him, but we can't." "Stop it," Jackie yells. "This is stressful enough without you freaking out." Kelton grits his teeth, anger growing. "You all have no idea, do you?" He points to the football field, which is just up a small hill. "You think there are no prisoners here? Take a look at that fence. Go up there and ask the people on the other side how long they've been waiting. Go on." And just to placate him, I do. "I'll be right back," I say. "Stay together." And I push through the crowd and up the grassy embankment. As I reach the football field, I'm hit by just how crowded it is. The stands, the track, the field. You can't even see the grass. It's all people. There are umbrellas and awnings set up to keep them in the shade, but not nearly enough. The fence is fairly high. All high school football fields have fences. They're to keep the fans of opposing teams from getting into fights with each other and to keep out people who didn't pay for a ticket. Today, at every gate, there are multiple armed soldiers. As much as I hate to admit it, Kelton's right. In the here and now, those fences are all about keeping people in. They've quarantined water zombies, thousands of them. "Excuse me," I call through the fence to anyone who'll respond. A bony woman with long, unkempt brown hair comes over to me. "Did you see?" she asks. "Did you see where they took it?" But I'm not sure what she's asking. She gets impatient. "The water! Did you see where they took it? We all saw the helicopter, but where did they take the water?" I did see them beginning to unload it, but I don't know where the water went. There are so many staging areas around this school, it could have gone anywhere. "No," I tell her. "I'm sorry, no." She slams her hand against the chain link fence, and it rattles. She bites her lip. She squints and starts blinking, and I realize what she's doing. She's crying. She's crying, but there are no tears left in her. Finally, I ask the question I came to ask. "How long have you been here?" "We came yesterday afternoon," she tells me. "This is only the third helicopter that's come since then, and the line never moves. We haven't seen any water. You have to find out where it's going." And then I hear Jackie behind me. "The gym," she yells over the crowd. "I saw them taking it to the gym. There's a lot of people there, too." The woman desperately grabs the fence so tightly her fingertips turn white. "You have to get some for us. You'll do that, won't you? You'll go to the gym and bring us some of that water?" There's nothing I can say to her. "Please promise you will do it. Please." "Alyssa, let's go." "I'm sorry," I say. I'm... Then Jackie gets in front of me, blocking my view of the woman, and moves me backward down the hill. "Don't engage," she tells me. "It won't help anyone, least of all you." I think to the box of agua viva in the bed of the pickup, hidden beneath a blanket. Is it still there? Did it get taken? Should I open it and start hurling bottles over the fence? But then I remember what happened yesterday when I brought water bottles to the Burnside house, and these people are far thirstier than that. Don't engage. How do you just walk away? And yet I do. I have to.
"So what did you find out?" asks Kelton when we get back to him.
He already knows the answer from the look on my face.
24. Henry.
I hadn't planned on leaving the others, I was just too busy being observant, taking in the situation around me. Then when the line diverged, I went the other way. But that's okay. I know where the others are, and although under any other circumstances I'd be better off as a free agent, I'm thinking our strange little fellowship might be worth maintaining. Or at least the Alyssa part of it. We'll see. I focus on the situation at hand. There are opportunities in every circumstance, even a circumstance as complex and troubling as the one around me. But as I take everything in, I'm finding it hard to see any opportunity whatsoever. Thousands of thirsty people. Water barrels being carried into the gym with a heavily armed entourage, and people trying to push their way through to those barrels with all the anguish of a Baroque painting. My heart is still racing from the encounter with the soldier back at the truck, but everything I see just makes it worse. The line I'm in is driving people toward the baseball field, but I can see it stopping before the entrance. That field is full, too. What the hell are they going to do with all these people? As the line devolves into a great milling mob, I slip away. There are soldiers everywhere, but plenty of spots are unguarded, and so far I haven't heard gunshots, so I'm assuming they're not shooting people who live outside the lines. I make my way to a less crowded area, keeping an eye on the entrance to the gym and those water barrels. My father always said, when you want to go somewhere you're not supposed to be, just walk in like you own the place, and 9 times out of 10 you'll get in. But I'm pretty sure this is that 10th time. And if I do get in, what then? I'm just one of thousands of people waiting for a taste of that water. That's not an opportunity. It's a dead-end deal. As I round a corner, I get a glimpse of the pool. Empty. They ran off with all the water in high school pools to use elsewhere, before they realized they'd be turning some of those schools into evacuation centers. There is no limit to short-sightedness in this world. But it's not the lack of pool water that troubles me. It's what I see on the pool deck. There are body bags there. Not just one or two, but at least a dozen. And something tells me there's going to be more. All right. All right. This isn't funny now. All right. All right. Maybe it never really was. All right. All right. There are dead people. In bags. And the helicopter flies away, and I have no idea when it will be back with water to keep other people from finding their way into bags. And I've never wet my pants, and I never will, but I swear to you I come really, really close.
Hey, you! You're not supposed to be here!
I don't need to be told again. I double back, heading to the place where people are still walking and breathing. Kelton was right. We can't stay here. And now I know exactly what I have to do. This is going to be a tough one. But if there's anyone who could swing a deal to end all deals, it's me.
Alyssa.
The line suddenly stops moving. More people come in behind us, and we're pushed up against the people in front of us, all crammed like cattle. I keep a hand on Garrett just to make sure we don't get separated. It's the soldiers behind us. They've begun to press against the crowd to clear a path in the road. And then empty school buses pull in like it's just an ordinary school day. "Your attention, please!" a voice blares over a sibilant bullhorn. "This evacuation center is at capacity!" Which is an understatement if there ever was one. I don't think it was equipped to handle even a fraction of the masses here. "These buses will take you to an overflow facility." "Where?" someone yells. "Where the hell are they taking us?" But no one gives an answer. As the parade of school buses continues to pour in, the soldiers make room for them in the lot. We're all uncomfortably close together, and I can smell everyone's breath, which isn't particularly good. Kelton doesn't even have to lean in to whisper within earshot. "They won't answer because they don't know," he says. "They're probably still trying to figure out where to send the buses, but wherever it is, it's not an evac center. They don't have the time or the manpower to set up anymore. all they can do is dump people in overflow facilities. Jackie has her elbows out, trying to keep her personal space. Why is it that you know all the answers? He doesn't bother to answer her. Instead, he says, Do you know the concept of social triage? No? Because I do. In a mass emergency, you help the ones you can. And the ones you can't help, you move out of the way. Then he looks to the first bus, where people are already beginning to obediently board. I can guarantee you that half the people who get on those buses are going to die. Because wherever they're going, it's away from water. I stand on my toes and look over people's heads at all the soldiers moving the giant herds. One of them kindly helps an elderly woman onto the bus. It's not like it's their intention to kill anyone, but after days without water, death needs no invitation. There are no fences around this parking lot, I point out. We're not trapped yet. But before I can formulate a plan, Henry comes into sight, bounding out of nowhere, out of breath and eyes wild. Looky what I got, he says, and holds up Uncle Basil's keychain, stupid rabbit's foot and all. It changes everything. How did you do that? I ask, hardly able to believe my eyes. I made a deal, he says. But we have to hurry. Come on. We run after him, fighting the current of people heading toward the buses. Wait, you traded with the guy who took the keys? Garrett realizes, profoundly impressed. He was going to arrest us. How did you make a trade with him? Because it's what I do, says Henry. Come on, we don't have much time. We get to the truck, and I immediately see the blanket in the back has been overturned, and the box that was hidden beneath it is gone. The water! At the mention of water, a dozen eyes turn in my direction. Forget about it, insists Henry. That's what I traded for the keys. Jackie looks at him, incredulous. You traded the last of the water for keys? Did it occur to you that we could hotwire it? Or run the hell away from here and find another truck? One that actually has air conditioning? But before he can answer, another voice broadsides the conversation. Hey, Roycroft, wait up! It makes Henry scramble even faster. A muscular meathead type pushes his way through the crowd, chapped lips, glassy-eyed, but not quite a water zombie yet. He grabs Henry by the shoulder and turns him around. Then the kid looks at Henry a little funny.
Hey, wait a second. You're not Trent Roycroft.
Henry ignores him and turns to the rest of us.
Just get in the truck.
But the jock will not be ignored.
Who the hell are you? Why are you wearing Roycroft's jacket? Where's Roycroft?
Henry fumbles with the keys and drops them. They skid underneath the truck.
Hey, says the meathead, I'm talking to you.
Then Henry dives underneath the truck, not like he's trying to get the keys, but like he's trying to escape. And now I realize that Jackie is gone.
Alyssa, says Garrett. He said to get in.
The door isn't locked, and Garrett climbs in the back seat with Kelton. I look for Jackie, but can't see her anywhere.
Damn her.
Henry emerges from underneath the car on the opposite side from the meathead, but right by the driver's door, and he has the keys again.
Hey, I asked you a question, the meathead calls to him.
And now with a car between them, Henry gives him an answer.
Go screw yourself.
Then Henry gets in, slamming the door hard. The meathead is more stunned than angry.
You know, I don't even think you go to Santa Margarita High School.
Henry starts the truck, and I jump into the passenger seat.
We have to wait for Jackie, I insist. We don't have time.
It's like something's snapped in Henry, if his name even is Henry. I have no idea of anything anymore. He throws the car into reverse, and we smash into the Toyota behind us that's boxing us in. He throws it in drive and does the same to the Audi in front of us. Then he reverses into the Toyota again, forcing the cars apart to give us space to pull out. And then I finally see Jackie. She's running toward us.
and she's carrying the Agua Viva box. No! Yells Henry when he sees her.
Finally, he's created enough damage and made enough room to pull the truck away from the curb. He lurches forward, scattering people heading toward the buses. By now, the soldiers have taken notice, and the one who made the trade is chasing Jackie, but she's too fast.
Henry swings a violent U-turn that takes down a little crepe myrtle tree on the island between lanes, and we're beached there, spinning our wheels, kicking up leaves and pink flowers. It gives Jackie enough time to reach us. She throws the box in the back, and realizing Henry has no intention of waiting for her to hop into the cab, she climbs the bumper and jumps into the bed along with the box and whatever other junk Uncle Basil has back there. Henry stomps on the gas, cursing, and rather than telling him what to do, I reach over and engage the four-wheel drive. Now when he hits the gas, we lurch forward, making sawdust of the little tree, and careen away from the school, leaving gawking people and frustrated soldiers who don't seem to be following us. They're just glad we're no longer their problem.
"Are you insane?" I scream at Henry. "You nearly killed us back there!"
He looks at me with those wild, snapped eyes.
"Killed you? Killed you? I just saved your lives! At least you could show some gratitude."
"Slow down," I demand. He's so frenetic he can't seem to find a lane. If there were more cars on the road, we'd have totaled the truck by now.
He grips the wheel tightly, looks straight ahead.
All right," he says, taking a deep breath. He steadies the car, eases up on the accelerator. All right, it's all under control now, it's all good." Then he turns to me. "There were body bags, Alyssa. Some of them were already full, but there were stacks and stacks and stacks of empty ones."
"There were?" says Garrett, wide-eyed, like someone just proved to him that the boogeyman was real.
"Do you see why I had to get us out of there, Alyssa? Do you? I had to save us, because if I didn't, no one else would have. Do you see?"
I nod. "Just keep your eyes on the road."
He turns to face forward.
All right, he says again, tamping down his panic, pretending it wasn't panic at all.
He's not driving well, but who would under these circumstances?
And then Kelton says, "There's nothing scary about a body bag. They're for transport and to prevent the spread of disease. I have one in my room. I use it for laundry."
There's a rap on the little back window of the cab. Jackie's hair is windswept, and she doesn't look happy back there.
"Stop the car," I tell Henry. "Let Jackie back in."
"I will be happy to let her in once we're far enough away from that place." And apparently 20 more yards down the road is far enough away, because he eases on the brake and pulls over to the side of the road. Jackie hops out of the truck bed and storms to Henry's window.
"Get the hell out! I'm driving!"
"In the back seat or not at all," Henry tells her.
"Not gonna happen," says Jackie.
"Fine, then not at all." And he throws the car in gear and pulls out, leaving her behind in a cloud of dust.
"God damn it!" yells Jackie, running after us.
"You can't just leave her here," I yell.
"I'm not," he tells me, now calm as can be. "This is a negotiation and I'm playing hardball." He stops the car to let Jackie catch up with us. "If you want to tie down a loose cannon, you can't give it much rope. Follow?" Jackie catches up with us, spewing wholly original combinations of foulness. Henry is not fazed.
"In the back seat," he says, "or I drive off and we part company for good."
Disgruntled, Jackie hops in the back, pushing Garrett into the middle and slams the door.
"Remind me to kill you in your sleep, Roycroft."
And then I remember she wasn't there when the jock blew Henry's cover. Henry, having found his comfort zone again, remains unfazed.
"So who's Roycroft?" I ask.
Henry doesn't even hesitate. "An asshole who traded me his letter jacket for 2 bottles of Agua Viva."
"Wait, what?" says Jackie. "You mean you've been lying to us all this time?"
"I never said my name was Roycroft. You just assumed, and I just went with it."
So what is your name? I ask. You know my name. Not your last name. We're on a first name basis, so why does it even matter? Then he turns around to glance at Kelton. So how do we get to the bug out?
Snapshot. 13 Ridgecrest, Dove Canyon. Herb was relieved to see his niece and nephew this morning, and glad they were okay. But he worries about his sister and brother-in-law. They would never have sent Alyssa and Garrett here without them. There was clearly something his niece wasn't saying, and who was this new girl? She was not one of Alyssa's usual friends. Kelton he could deal with. Everyone had a weird but mostly harmless neighbor kid to contend with. But this Jackie had a red flag vibe about her. He closes his eyes and steadies himself against the banister at the bottom of the stairs. The ache of his fever and the weight of his own body is telling his brain that the staircase might as well be Mount Everest. He takes a deep, shuddering breath and sighs. One crisis at a time. He can't wring his hands over his sister now, or about his niece's choice of traveling companions. Besides, the fact that Alyssa and the others haven't come back is a good sign. He heard the unmistakable sound of his truck driving down the street. He'd bet a pretty penny that they were in that car when it left. He takes the stairs, one step at a time, pausing for a breath between each one, all the while chiding himself for trusting the tap water once they switched the source to the old tank on the hill. Everyone in the neighborhood was so full of their own cleverness at having jury-rigged a solution to the tap-out. And so they drank. And Herb drank. And Daphne drank. They sated themselves on stagnant water that had been sitting untreated in a dark tank for who knew how long. It didn't taste bad. Didn't make you spit it out grimacing. Yes, it was a little bit earthy, but that was all. He wondered if anyone had the good sense to boil it first before drinking it. Probably not. There's a false sense of security when you turn on a shiny chrome tap in your own kitchen. Yes, you expect it not to taste quite as good as filtered water, what with all the fluoride and chlorine and whatever the hell else they treat the water with, but you don't expect it to kill you. How could anyone have known? Now, the community has been unusually quiet. It took a while for him to realize that such a semblance of peace was the biggest indication of how bad things had really become. No one's coming out of their homes, because like him and Daphne, they're just too sick and weak. Halfway to the top of the stairs now. He holds a bottle of agua viva in one hand and grips the banister with the other. The only reason he's still able to stand is that he's been keeping the agua viva down. Yes, it goes right through him, but while it's coursing through his troubled intestines, some of it must get absorbed. It gave him the strength to keep himself mostly together for Alyssa and Garrett. They didn't see how hard he was struggling just to stand. Besides, the sight of them did give him an adrenaline boost. Now he's paying for that, though, as wave after wave of weakness hits him. The top step. He stands there catching his breath and trying to ignore the throbbing in his joints. He thinks this might be the last time he attempts the stairs. For a while. Just for a while. He steps into the master bedroom, where the stench has gotten worse. He's already changed the sheets twice today. He doesn't know if he has it in him to change them again, but he knows he will. He doesn't announce his arrival. Herb stopped talking to Daphne yesterday. It just became too painful to do once she stopped talking back. So now he silently cares for her, feeding her small bits of soft food, hoping she'll finally start holding it down, and drizzling agua viva into her mouth, which makes her cough and gag, then comes right back up onto the white sheets. He sits on the edge of the bed, touching her pale skin, so thin now he can see the veins beneath. Her eyes are like dull marbles that stare through him. They don't even blink. He listens, but he can't hear her breathe, so he puts his head to her chest, listening for a heartbeat. It's there. Weak. Strained. She's climbing her own Everest without even moving. He wonders what he'll do when he puts his head to her chest and hears nothing. Then, as he prepares to get up to change the sheets, something catches his eye by Daphne's bedside. There's a little orange prescription bottle that wasn't there before. Did someone leave it here? Who could have done that? Herb was never one to believe in miracles. Certainly no miracle came to save his farm, or for that matter, anything else he had lost in his life. But when he sees that pill bottle, and the label reading, Keflex, he has to reevaluate his whole concept of reality. 26. Kelton.
Strangers. I'm in a car with strangers. Jackie, mysterious and deranged. Then there's Henry, who isn't who he says he is. Even Alyssa and Garrett are question marks, because it's like I don't know anyone anymore. But the biggest stranger is me. Sure, I know my name. I know where I live, or lived, because I don't know if I even live there anymore. I have all the same memories, but the new memories, the one memory that keeps playing in my head, along with the sound of that shotgun blast, has rendered everything that happened before that moment completely irrelevant. Just before dawn this morning, when it came to fight or flight, my body finally chose fight. When it's flight, you're swept away by a force. But when it's fight, you're giving in to an even stronger one. I would have done some heavy damage if Alyssa hadn't knocked me out. At least now I'm filled with confidence that the fight function exists within me. And maybe now that I know what it is and what it feels like, perhaps I can start to control its power. As a result, I do find myself giving in to more violent, destructive thoughts. Like how when that soldier pointed his gun at me, a part of me wanted him to blast my brain into the next county. I wanted Henry to run people over on the way out. I wanted things to explode, and I want everyone to feel the shrapnel as deep as I do. I know it's wrong, but the feelings course through me, and who am I to try to stop them? But then my mother's voice comes to me. My mother, who might be dead for all I know. And she says, "Things pass, even big things, and when they're far behind us, they don't look big anymore." And my father's voice, too. Sterner, but still with the authority of experience. "Everything in life is a lesson, Kelton. Learn from it. Better yourself. Become stronger." The best way to honor them is to listen to them. To believe them. But it's hard. So very, very hard.
"So how do we get to the bug out?"
I hear Henry ask, and I realize I have a mission. To take the blast. To be strong enough to block the shrapnel from hitting the others. Yeah, a part of me wants everyone to feel the pain, but I'm better than that. Stronger than a shotgun blast. My brother is dead, but I am not, and I will do what I have to do today. "We need to find Santiago Creek," I tell him. "It won't be far from here." "A creek?" Jackie questions, now suddenly interested by the notion of water. "It's all dried up," I inform her. "And besides, it's an urban creek," I explain. "So, expect a lot of concrete and graffiti."
"I thought you said we needed a map."
"It would help, but I'm pretty sure I have the waterways memorized. There's a map with the aqueducts and drainage channels all marked up in our garage." Henry looks at me like I'm from another galaxy, and I start to feel defensive. "We've been preparing," I explain.
"If you haven't noticed by now," Jackie explains to him, "the tap-out is like Christmas for Kelton."
Which pisses me off, because maybe at one point she would have been right, but now it's just a nightmare, and she knows that. I shoot her a death glare that, if there was justice, would make her head explode. And for the first time, I think she gets the picture, and actually shuts up. As we continue north, it becomes increasingly apparent to everyone else what I already know. There's no escaping the military takeover. We pass an open canopy truck crammed full of soldiers. Random Humvees are parked on corners. Helicopters tear through the sky overhead. Then we dead end at a traffic-jammed road. There's another roadblock up ahead, and soldiers directing people down another suburban funnel that leads either back to the high school or to an overflow facility that will be the last place to see water. There are no roads left in all of Southern California that go anywhere we want to be. Alyssa turns to Henry, alarmed. We can't get caught in that again.
I thought your doomsday dog was navigating.
I don't know whether to be annoyed or flattered that Henry, not Roycroft, is spending all his mental energy coming up with nicknames for me.
Didn't you say you had the map memorized? Jackie says to me.
I have the map of the aqueducts memorized, not these roads.
And on paper, you're technically supposed to be smarter than me, right? So why don't you tell us how to get out of here?
Not my neighborhood, Jackie shrugs.
But I'm glad we established that I'm smarter than you.
Do you want to find the aqueducts? Alyssa interjects. Or just snipe at each other until they put us on a death bus to nowhere?
Wait, Garrett says. Is it like a concrete ditch where kids skateboard?
And now we're all looking at him.
Yes. I know where it is. Turn right here, and then left at the ugly cow, then look for a jack-in-the-box. It's in the back behind the parking lot.
We follow Garrett's directions and come to a corner where there's a mom-and-pop ice cream place on the corner. On the roof is the saddest-looking plastic cow I've ever seen.
Should I turn left? Says Henry. Or is there an uglier cow up ahead?
He turns without waiting for Garrett's answer, and we see a jack-in-the-box a few dozen yards ahead. We pull into the empty parking lot and to the far back fence, where there's a concrete aqueduct stretching as far as the eye can see in both directions. It's amazing how places like this can be here, cutting right through your own neighborhood. But for most people, it's completely off their radar. Unless you're a prepper. Or a skateboarder. The concrete is mottled salt and pepper, stained from the sediment of old storm surges, but Santiago Creek hasn't had running water for a few years now. We come to a stop. I can see that there's no visible entrance. It's blocked off by a tall chain-link fence topped with barbed wire. My father would know where the entrance would be. But that's no use to us now.
I used to fit in through that hole right there, Garrett says.
That's not big enough for the truck, Alyssa says, pointing out the obvious. Just looking at the fortified nature of the fence, even if we had the luxury of time, I doubt we would find an opening big enough. And I doubt even more that Alyssa and Garrett's uncle has bolt cutters in the back.
I've seen kids on bikes down there, Garrett says. They've got to get there somehow.
Another helicopter soars overhead, the relentless beat of its blades making me anxious. Searching for an access point large enough for us might take hours.
We're going to have to bust through it, Jackie says, not even trying to hide the excitement in her voice.
I question her intentions, as always, but it's not like we have any better options right now. Now all eyes are on Henry in the driver's seat. He looks back at us, the pressure getting to him.
Even if we can get through, it's kind of steep.
Which is definitely an understatement. I look down into the crevasse and instantly get that sick-to-my-stomach feeling, like that terrifying moment before chickening out of dropping into a half-pipe. Sadly, I have intimate relations with that moment. The aqueduct is shaped like an upside-down trapezoid, with a steep downslope that abruptly levels off for 20 yards, then slopes upward again. The flat portion in the middle always reminds me of the racing scene in Grease, only I'm sure John Travolta is a much better driver than Henry. Hell, his car flies in the end. Henry throws the car in reverse and begins to back up, like a bull before charging a matador.
Are you sure we want Henry to do this? Alyssa asks. What about his arm?
It's fine now, Henry says, which is a lie. I'm sure it still aches, but it probably won't affect his driving. Still, I'm just as wary as Alyssa.
I think, Jack, you might have more experience driving, I suggest.
No, I do, he insists.
You're what, 17? Jackie points out. How much experience could you have?
I've been driving since I was 13, he says. Don't ask. So we don't. After all, he did manage to maneuver us out of the high school. Granted, he damaged a bunch of cars and killed a defenseless tree in the process. Under normal circumstances, that would not be considered skilled driving, but these are not normal circumstances.
I calculate the metrics of it all. You want to hit the fence with enough speed to break through, but not enough for us to lose control and flip into the channel.
So how fast?
He coughs, trying to hide the little quiver of fear in his voice. I weigh the variables and make a guess that sounds far more educated than it actually is. 30 miles per hour,
and since we don't have much of a runway, we'll need to accelerate quickly. Once we get down there, you'll want to turn left. Henry takes a breath and finds the closest thing he has to a happy place.
Okay, are we ready?
Yes, just do it already, Jackie yells from the back seat.
All right.
And like that, we're off. Henry increases the pressure on the accelerator. I can hear the tires peeling out beneath us. We rocket forward. My body presses back against the seat with the acceleration. We're closing the distance between us and the fence quickly. But just before we do, Henry suddenly hits the brakes, bailing, the way I bail from half pipes. But it's too late. We're moving too fast. We collide with the chain link fence, but rather than busting through it, it holds. And then I realize it's slowly bending forward. I can hear the metal brackets that hold the fence to the support poles begin to snap. The fence clangs and twangs like a weird musical instrument, and the nose of the truck begins to dip forward, revealing a gorge like a roller coaster drop. The slope is much steeper than it had seemed. We're going to die, is all I can think. Suspended over the edge, the car hangs in the fence like someone in a hammock. Then, the fence finally gives way. We fly down the slope and the nerves in my stomach flutter up into my throat like I'm about to puke. I brace myself, and we hit the level concrete, the shocks absorbing most of it. Still, we're slammed back into our seats and everything bounces. Henry cranks the wheel left, as instructed, and we fishtail until he manages to gain control, straightening out, then punches the gas. And we're gliding on the concrete riverbed. I look out the window. We're carving the aqueduct like we're surfing. After that rough drop, it feels so smooth. I find myself laughing out of disbelief, and Jackie screams out of excitement. The others are just relieved.
That was awesome!
Garrett bursts out, looking to Henry, starry-eyed. But as cool as Garrett thinks Henry is, it doesn't change the fact that this was wildly dangerous. If we had leveled out with any more speed, or at any steeper an angle, we would have totaled or even flipped. Henry smiles, pleased with himself.
I knew 30 miles per hour was just too fast, he says,
like hitting the brakes was the result of calculation and not fear. But I'm so thankful to be alive right now, he could take credit for the faked lunar landings and I wouldn't care. But then I realize,
the Agua Viva.
I twist in my seat to get a better look at the truck bed through the rear window.
It's still there, Jackie reassures us all. Some of the bottles could have been damaged,
Garrett notes coyly.
Maybe we should open up the box just to see.
But I know exactly where this is going. I think we all do. Henry puts an end to it.
Agua Viva bottles are made of durable, low-density polyethylene and are BPA-free,
Henry informs us.
I promise you, nothing in that box will leak.
And although agreeing with Henry on any level makes me cringe, I say, besides, we don't want to open that box until we have no choice. Temptation is not our friend right now. There will be more than enough water at the bug out. We'll need to save our reserve for emergencies. I'm surprised that we got that Agua Viva box back anyway. I find myself shaking my head and smiling at Jackie.
You are totally insane to go after that box, you know that?
And she grins, knowing that I mean it as a compliment, something I'm not sure she's used to getting.
So are you, she responds. I choose to take it as a compliment as well.
I wonder what it would have been like if I had crossed paths with Jackie in other circumstances. Then again, I highly doubt that would ever happen. This girl lives on a totally different dimensional plane than the rest of us. If the tap out never happened, she would be nothing but a name on an SAT score I couldn't beat. Realizing that my thoughts are no longer nagging anxieties, I finally take a moment to breathe. We all do. Jackie leans forward and turns on the radio. Nothing but emergency broadcasts, telling people where to go, where not to go, and to remain calm. A one-size-fits-all relief effort that doesn't actually fit anyone.
Our uncle has satellite radio, Alyssa points out, and switches to the satellite stations.
Suddenly, Smooth Criminal assaults our eardrums, which, in this place, in this moment, sounds like the best song in the world. Impulsive as ever, Jackie reaches forward and opens up the sunroof, then stands, her entire torso protruding dangerously out of it, indulging in the high of another adrenaline rush. After a while, Alyssa tugs at Jackie's blouse. Enough. And then, as soon as Jackie comes down, Alyssa, all smiles, jumps up and pops her head through, too. Jackie shoves her like she would a bratty sister. Then Garrett, of course, demands his turn. Sharing. What a concept. If we're a messed-up, dysfunctional family, I guess this can go down as our single functional moment. I roll down my window and stick my hand out. I close my eyes and open up my fingers, letting my hand cut through the wind. I look through the window and marvel at the world outside. Hazy afternoon sunlight pours down from the sky. The light glimmers against the concrete path like ribbons of gold. And I'm realizing that this is the first time we felt relatively free in a long time. Like we weren't escaping from the place we once called home. Like this wasn't a suburban apocalypse. I can't forget the events of the past 24 hours, but here, speeding along a concrete wash, I can let them trail behind me, if only for a few moments. It's the briefest hint that no matter what happened or happens, life might actually go on. It's Henry who brings us back to reality. There's a junction coming up, he yells over the whipping wind. Stay left, I tell him. It's Alyssa who points out that we're heading southwest, toward the shore, not the mountains. It's okay, I tell her. We're traveling a river system. We have to go down this tributary until we reach the main river. Henry bears left at the junction. When we reach the main riverbed, we'll make a hard right and take the river all the way up to the mountains, I tell everyone. I used to brag to everyone that I had a photographic memory, but this is the true test. The channel we're in loses its brutal edge and becomes natural for a while. Wild, like a true riverbed. Then we're riding on concrete again, in an area more industrial than before. Another junction. Henry makes the hard right, and the dashboard compass shows that we're now heading north. We're in a much wider channel now, the Santa Ana River, although it's really just the memory of a river. All Southern California waterways have become like phantom limbs. We might feel that they're still there, but it's just an illusion cast in cement. I have a better idea of where we are on the map. There are even some landmarks along the way that help guide us. Angel Stadium, the Honda Center, which reminds me that we're not too far from Disneyland. I can't even imagine what kind of madness is going down there right now. Last year, as a show of community support and shrewd marketing, they drained their artificial waterways. The Jungle Cruise became a VR ride. Pirates and Small World were converted to magnetic levitation, and they opened up Grand Canyon land in the dry moat around Tom Sawyer's island. So anyone who thinks they can jump the fence now and suck down the guano-tainted blue-dyed water will have a rude awakening. As we travel this expansive concrete channel, it feels to me like the world has torn in two, and we're traveling the seam of that tear, the chasm between what was and what will be. We're no longer part of any world, or at least I'm not. Everything that used to mean something to me is on the outside, hopelessly out of reach. I think about my brother. I think about my parents. I feel numb now. Like how, after a really bad burn, once the pain subsides, you lose all sensation in the spot. That's because the nerve endings are dead. And yet, I think right now the best place for me to be is the chasm between the tattered edges of life as we knew it. The chasm takes many forms as we travel. In some places, we have to slow down because there are rocks, branches, and other obstacles that I imagine were swept up in a current when this place actually transported water. Other parts, we have to crawl at an excruciatingly slow pace because of rocks bulldozed into 5-foot berms, intentionally formed into a maze designed to direct the flow of water. It's as if the chasm itself is an obstacle course created to defeat us. But we will not be defeated. Another hour in, and we encounter a dam. Was this on your mental map? Jackie asks. I don't answer that. Instead, I say, dams have always been an access route for heavy machinery to reach both sides. We drive along the face of the dam,
then double back for about 100 yards and find the access path. It's gated, but the gate is pretty rusty. We ram it, doing 50, which was probably overkill, because the gate flies off its hinges. Jackie whoops with excitement, invigorated. Alyssa endures it, Garrett's all smiles, and Henry remains all business, keeping his hands gripping the wheel at 10 and 2. Me? I'm still numb. Crashing the gate barely raised my resting heart rate. The gate on the other side of the dam is open, so Henry doesn't have to do a repeat performance as we descend the accessway. We find ourselves in a sprawling flood basin, which means we've crossed from Orange into Riverside County. Now my eyelids are becoming heavy. It must be the sleep debt I owe my body, the accumulated hours of missed rest over the past 4 days. Then I imagine the water debt we've all worked up by now. We were hydrated yesterday, but we've also been sweating a great deal in this heat. The last water we had was just a little bit that Alyssa's uncle gave us early in the morning. Now it's way into the afternoon, almost evening. Water deprivation and 100-degree heat doubles, maybe triples, the dehydration clock. I'll be glad when the sun sets. I can only hope we'll reach the bug out by then. There's a smell of smoke in this flood basin, faint but constant, probably from the various brush fires we heard about on the news. Bad air tends to settle in basins.
Is this it? Henry asks. Is the bug out somewhere around here?
Not even close, I tell him. We're in the Prado Flood Control Basin. 3 rivers feed into here, or at least they used to. Take the leftmost one.
Great, says Jackie. Let's find out what's behind door number 1.
We bounce and rattle over the dusty, tumbleweed-ridden terrain until we see another concrete channel up ahead, not quite as wide as the Santa Ana River. This one has sides that are straight up and down, no slope at all. There's the normal stuff you'd expect to see in a drainage ditch, old tires, rusty shopping carts, broken sofas that seem to have fallen from space, a brand new obstacle course. There's not enough junk to stop us, just to keep us on edge as we weave a serpentine path around it all.
This is like the crap that gets caught behind furniture cushions, Jackie comments, but on a cosmic scale.
There's more graffiti on the walls of the ditch here, too. Colorful tags like wrong and orgy and stoops and others so stylized they seem written in an alien language, adding to the feeling that we're in a completely different world. About an hour into this channel, we come across people who have set up camp on either side of the aqueduct, and it doesn't look like a new occurrence. There are dozens of pitched tent dwellings made of tarps and blankets and makeshift supports, like some sort of skid row. I think of what Jackie said, and realize that it's not only things that get lost behind the cushions of the world. People do, too. With the sun sinking low and shadows getting long, the place looks even more eerie than it would in the bright light of this hot day. The closer we get, the clearer it becomes that this is a permanent homeless encampment. If it is, they definitely haven't read The Art of War, which points out that setting up camp in a ditch is a death wish. High ground offers visibility. Low ground leaves you open for an ambush. Still, I get the feeling that ambush is not high on their list of worries. Alyssa keeps her gaze straight ahead. Don't slow down, she says.
I wasn't intending to, says Henry.
She keeps her eyes forward, refusing to even look at the people in the encampment. It seems out of character for her, and makes me think about how she agreed with my father yesterday. Either you give everything, or nothing at all. And I realize why she's refusing to look. For a girl like her, whose first instinct is always to fix a situation, the nothing-at-all choice isn't easy. It's painful. But after everything that's happened, she realizes that her and Garrett's survival requires the kind of aggressive hardness she usually reserves for the soccer field. Today, there's no taking a knee for the players who fall. As we slowly drive through the encampment, some of those lost souls emerge from their tents and watch us go by. They don't stop us. They don't bother us. They just watch. I think they're just being vigilant, making sure we don't stop to harass them. I look at their weathered faces, their worn clothes, and I wonder what their stories are, and how they landed here. If there's anyone thinking about them or wishing them well. Then I realize that by the way they're looking at us, they're wondering the same. Soon, we're past, and I hear Alyssa release a breath of relief. How much farther? Henry asks, about 45 minutes past the homeless encampment. While it's not quite dusk, the entire channel is now in shadows. I squint. There's absolutely no signage on these aqueducts, let alone the fact that I can barely see, now that the sun has practically gone down. Just keep going, I tell him. Eventually, we'll get to the Foothill Freeway. The Angeles National Forest is just past that. The compass now reads northwest, and everything feels right. Until we pass into a tunnel that at first I think is just another underpass. But there's no other side. We're suddenly in complete darkness. Henry hits the brakes, and we come to a stop. Turn on the headlights, Alyssa says. I can't find them. I can hear Henry frantically scratching away at dials until he eventually finds the headlights. He flicks them on, and for the briefest, crazy instant, I expect to see something like a T-Rex glaring through the windshield. I don't know why my brain dredges up that image, but when the lights flash on, I jump. Of course there's nothing there. Nothing but a drainage culvert. All we can really see are the ribbed walls around us, flaking with dried moss, and the tunnel ahead lit by our headlights. Correction, headlight. Only one is working. Great. So much for nighttime visibility. So, Jackie says to me, is this part of the urban river experience, or are we lost? Quiet, I'm thinking. Like I said, I'd only been to the bug out a couple of times, but we took normal roads. Dad had once brought us this way, virtually, in an annoyingly detailed PowerPoint. But I think I would have remembered the endless black tunnel portion of the presentation. We must have missed a turn, I'm forced to admit. And the thing is, I have no idea where that turn would have been. I know we took the correct path out of the flood basin. That was hours back. If there was a hidden fork, it could be anywhere between here and there. Then, I begin to wonder if the walls deeper into the tunnel might be moist. What if there's water down here? Which makes me think about the many species of animals that have most likely infested these parts, no matter how contaminated the water. Then, I think about how many humans might have wandered in with the same intentions, and I realize that my brain short-circuited and kicked out the wrong image. It's not dinosaurs we need to be worrying about. It's people. Turn around, I tell Henry. Get us out of here. But a U-turn is an impossibility. Henry kicks the car in reverse and we roll backward until we're out of the tunnel. It's twilight now, harder to see much of anything, and the channel is still too narrow to make a turn, so we reverse back the way we came, slowly, carefully, with nothing to guide us but our dim red taillights. Half an hour later, we still haven't found another fork. Are you sure we weren't just supposed to go straight? Alyssa asks. Through the tunnel? Yes, I tell her. No, I say. I don't know, I finally admit. Maybe we can just back our way into the homeless camp, Jackie says, oozing sarcasm. I'm sure they'll be more than happy to help us. We continue to wind backwards for a few more minutes. Then Alyssa cries out, There! Do you see it? And there it is, a spur in the channel heading off to the right, due north. The mouth is choked with weeds, and there's some bright graffiti to the left, which pulled our attention the first time we passed. I'm incredibly relieved. If we couldn't find it, I had no idea what we would do. Henry takes us out of reverse and steers us down the proper path. But not long after we begin our new route, the channel forks again. And now, I'm questioning if we're even in the right aqueduct to begin with. Like they say, when it rains, it pours. However, when the heavens have no water left to give, I'm starting to realize the powers that be just find the next best way to screw you over. Because the low fuel light pings on. Of course. In all this time driving, we never once thought about gas. I might have been to blame for misdirecting us, but for this, I blame Henry. How could you have not checked the gas gauge? I say. Excuse me, but I've been a little busy. What's the big deal? Jackie says. Wasn't there an access path leading back up to the streets a little ways back? What use is that? Alyssa says. The gas stations aren't pumping, and we'll be facing military detours again. Spoken like a true prisoner of lawful behavior, she says. Alyssa doesn't get it, but I do. So we siphon gas from an abandoned car. Jackie nods. And I'm sure there are plenty of them on the freeway we just passed under.
Twenty-seven. Alyssa.
Our entire dynamic has definitely changed since we brought Henry on. I can't tell whether that's good or bad. He's not the best driver, but he's competent and keeps his eyes glued to the road. He did manage to get our keys back so we could get away from the evac center, and he seems to genuinely want to help us. On the other hand, he was taking advantage of the people in his neighborhood, including my uncle, and he kinda sorta pretended to be someone he wasn't. I'm not quite sure what to make of him, and it's annoying that he's not all that unpleasant to look at, because that could cloud my judgment. We have to backtrack a little farther than we would like to find the access way to the street, and I'm just happy the truck hasn't run out of gas yet. We barely make it up the concrete path, which is so narrow that looking out of the window, I can no longer see the ground beneath us, and the steep drop to the bottom just continues to grow. If our right tires slip off the ledge, we'll flip multiple times before reaching the bottom. Finally, we make it to street level. I have no idea where we are, and the fact that so much of Southern California looks alike is disconcerting. I know it's not home, but it's familiar in its unfamiliarity. The neighborhood is older than ours, with aging ranch-style homes, but a strip mall on the corner looks no different here than in my neighborhood. The air tastes acrid and burnt, and it's heavy to breathe in. It's smoke from the fires. They call this part of California the Inland Empire. And it's always smoggy, because whatever nastiness is in the air gets blown here and caught against the mountains. I feel like I played a soccer tournament in this town. Or maybe it was another town 100 miles away that looked exactly the same. We roll up to a freeway on-ramp, and Jackie suggests that we reverse in to get our gas tank as close as possible to whichever car we choose. Funny how Kelton knows everything about this anarchic world, but it feels like Jackie's already lived it. Turns out, backing in isn't necessary, because, surprisingly, the on-ramp isn't congested with abandoned cars. But then I guess that's not surprising at all. Anyone who realized that traffic was at a permanent standstill would eventually be able to back out. You'd have to be deep into the massive automotive clot to feel that abandoning your car was your only course of action. So the freeway is pretty much empty for 50 yards or so until we hit the first abandoned cars and finally the full-on clog through which there is no passage and from which there was no escape. Some cars are turned at bizarre angles, some face in the wrong direction entirely. There are broken windows, doors wide open, an empty car seat on a roof. Up ahead, I see an abandoned yellow school bus. The scene isn't quite like it was back at the beach, where the evidence of panic and violence painted a chilling story. And yet the abject nature of this abandonment is just as disturbing. People walked away with nothing but the clothes on their backs and their kids in their arms. Any vandalism must have come after the fact, and that implies that there might still be marauders smashing windows and water zombies wandering the labyrinth. First, we're going to need to find a hose, says Jackie, as we pull to a stop. We fan out looking for a gardening truck or something that might have a hose, but no luck. Then, on a hunch, I check the back of Uncle Basil's truck. There's a lot of junk back there.
things that our uncle didn't have the strength to care about when he made the deal with Henry, so they just went along with the truck. Tumbled among the stuff that had been tossed around in our rough ride, I find his hookah. Mom always made him keep it in the backyard because she didn't want the thing in the house, and I remember him once mentioning that Daphne refused to allow it in her sight at all. So it stayed in the back of the truck, its 4-foot hose hiding in plain sight. Hopefully, it will be long enough to do the job. Henry backs toward one of the cars at the edge of the clot, and only after getting out to look for its gas cap do we realize he's not going to find one. It's a Tesla. Jackie notices it first. She taps me and points it out, but doesn't tell Henry, who is still looking for a place to stick the hose. The rest of us get it now, but wait to see how long it takes for Henry to catch on. I find myself smiling at the irony of it. Not just the Tesla, but Henry in his entirety. The world goes dry, yet we find Henry totally oblivious, living in his own little oasis. He let us think he was someone else for no apparent reason. He's clearly smart, but lacks basic common sense in the strangest of ways. He doesn't seem entirely trustworthy, but when you look in his eyes, you really want to trust him. It's like he wants to be trusted, as if the very act of trusting him will suddenly make him worthy of it. I want him to be worthy of our trust. So does that mean I have to trust him first? I can't help but be a little intrigued by his unknown quotient. "Isn't anyone going to help me?" Henry finally asked.